Hello, I'm Julian Rubinstein, and welcome back to the second series of News Roast. Now, we need your help. Can you please, if you enjoy this podcast, subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes, Audioboom, Spotify, Stitcher, whatever you're listening to our podcast on? Because for us to actually get sponsorship for the show, it needs to be high, particularly in the iTunes chart. And so we need you to help us help you, give you the best guests possible. We've got some incredible people lined up, but we cannot do it unless you are helping us by rating and reviewing and subscribing to the podcast. So thank you very much and enjoy the show. So, welcome to News Roast, being recorded on location.
Yes, at Ken Loach's office.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ken. And we spotted some reels over there, Ken, and we were wondering what they were.
Well, this is for you youngsters. This is what we call film.
Film.
It's what we call film.
Film.
And it's celluloid with holes, what we call sprockets down the sides, and they run on cogs past the light, and hey presto, you have a moving image.
Jesus.
And it's what we call film. And do you know what? It's actually better than the digital because it's like oils, paints and watercolours.
Yeah.
It has more depth, more vibrancy, more substance. And so we still shoot on film. And we would cut on film, but the technology is disappearing like a sandcastle under the tide. It's a good medium.
So you'll always shoot on film?
As long as, yes, as there's breath in my body.
Was I Daniel Blake shot on film?
Yes, of course.
Oh, yes. I didn't know that.
Yes, but then the trouble is you go digital to grade it because the grading process, which you used to do on film, obviously, has gone. So it was a very highly skilled job of a film grader, and they've more or less gone now.
Lost their jobs.
The process has gone, and so you have to grade digitally. And the problem is, then you have to go digital, and so a lot of the depth of the picture tends to go. I find.
So you lose it in the transfer.
Because we have limited time, won't, speak of... First of all, thank you so much for spending some time with Hayden and myself. We're huge fans of your work.
Oh, thank you very much.
You know, you're a luminary of British cinema. And I suppose most recently, the film I, Daniel Blake, which, you know, won the Palme d'Or in Cannes. Were you surprised by the sort of international success of that story? Or were you expecting it?
Well, you never know quite what to expect. I mean, you can work really hard on something and, you know, the pudding doesn't rise, as it were, or you do something really quickly and it's, for some reason, it just catches fire, to mix my metaphors horribly.
Mm-hmm.
And
good.
We were surprised. I mean, it's a very specific little story.
Mm.
But I think one of the lessons that you learn over and over again is that the more specific you are, the more an idea carries. And the more you go for a generalised idea, the less connection it makes. And it's a paradox, but the more specific, the more people see their own situation in parallel or
so you think alongside. You sort of caught a bit of the zeitgeist. People were sort of starting to become incredibly angry about what was going on.
Yeah.
Your film captured that story.
Yeah, well, I think it's a state using its bureaucracy consciously in a cruel way to punish the poor, and that's happening across Europe, but obviously the details vary, but that essential fact of the state humiliating, denigrating, and punishing people who are very vulnerable, that happens in one way or another. Austerity is there one way or another. I mean, just look at what happened in Greece. You know, people there absolutely identify with it, and they have across Europe, and even in Scandinavia, where you think, oh, things are different there. So no, it did surprise us, but it's been extraordinary, really.
You were quoted as saying recently about the UK benefit system that it's a Kafkaesque catch-22 situation designed to frustrate and humiliate the claimants to such an extent that they drop out of the system and stop pursuing their right to ask for support if necessary. Did that come after sort of researching the film, or did you believe that before?
Well, I mean, It began when Paul Laverty, the writer, and I kept exchanging messages and stories, like the one in the film, where people needing support, I mean, either because they're sick or they're out of work or they were working but they were still desperately poor. Good God.
Oh, Ken. I thought they told you to turn your phone off in the cinema. Well, this director, Ken Loach, totally interrupting our recording. Unbelievable.
What can you
You're
say?
Fired, Ken. Right, that's okay. It. It's your, so you're done.
It's my daughter, but I went with it.
Of course, get it if you get it.
I will, okay. Oh, she's gone now.
Oh, she's gone.
Yeah.
She's probably listening to a podcast, Ken.
No,
I should say, Ken was absolutely fascinated by this podcast thing. It's not something that he's not. He was like, "What? Who's this for?" It's, like, it's a podcast, yeah. But who is it? It's for the listeners, Ken.
That's the future. Masses. You're going to have to start directing podcasts.
Yes, you see, I can't. I can just about make a call. You see, I didn't actually manage to answer that call that I should have. I should have answered.
Ken Loach interrupting the interview with a telephone.
With
call.
A telephone call. What can I say? And it's also turned to silent, or so I thought. I thought I was
unbelievable.
Unbelievable. What I'll do, I'll put it to. Flight mode, would that be a good
one? Flight mode's a good one. Yeah,
is that a good one?
Flight mode, hey?
It's a good, I generally go for flight mode when I'm in the cinema or in the theatre.
Yes. A good tip for you, Ken. You can charge your phone twice as fast in flight mode. For any listener who probably doesn't know that, I imagine that's absolutely none. It's a well-known thing by the youth, Ken.
Is it?
The youth of today.
The youth.
Yeah.
How is she? Well, that
says Julian at 36.
I don't know what you're talking about.
We are down with the youth.
This week's sponsor is Cornerstone. Who are Cornerstone, Haid?
Cornerstone is a flexible subscription-based service where you can tailor your shaving supplies and delivery frequency to meet your needs.
With the new Cornerstone razor, the real difference you'll notice is in the quality and smoothness of the shave. I can attest to this myself. And thanks to the unique three-step engineering process pioneered by our friends in the new factory in Düsseldorf, Germany, it's off the chain.
It's off the chain. There's one thing that is true, and that's that Germans are good at engineering things that are off the chain.
Fact.
And the full details can be found at cornerstone.co.uk/roast. That's cornerstone.co.uk/roast.
You'll find more information on how they will even engrave chrome-plated handles. That's chrome-plated handles, my friends, on your new Cornerstone razor.
But not only that, they can put initials... Your initials onto the chrome plated handle.
I mean, you could even give it as a gift to your father.
You could. That's a good
or your brother. Or maybe even
your
a woman
mom.
With a beard.
Yes.
Who knows? You can customize each box with other shaving products to suit your needs. So you can try out their full range of balms and lovely creams to keep you silky smooth. And arrange for them to be delivered as often as you need them.
Do you use their balms?
I do. And they are very, very balmy.
Oh. You can customise each box with other shaving products, and we've done that. Prices range from £14 to £30 per box per month, and listeners get £10 off their first box. Go to cornerstone.co.uk/roast or enter the promo code ROAST10 at checkout.
That's cornerstone.co.uk/roast. You're welcome. So... As we said, this is three courses of conversation. So what have you brought us for our succulent starter?
Well, I thought something savoury, something to send a shiver down the spine of the establishment, like a good aperitif.
Nice.
And that's I hate the term, but are generally called the mainstream media, particularly broadcasting, is actually an arm of the state. That it's not that the idea of objectivity is, of course, an impossible concept, but that even given that problem of language, it is used by the state that may be critical of the government, but is used by the state to maintain the principal ideas of the state. Mm. I'm thinking particularly of the BBC and ITV. And of course, the press will do that of their own volition because they're owned by big multinational corporations and individuals. So I guess that's my first dish I'm putting on the table.
Mainstream
is that
media.
The BBC, particularly,
right,
and everything else follows suit, is actually an arm of the state and defends the interests of the state based on the ruling class.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? Because for a long time, people thought of the BBC as like a pinko institution that was sort of abjectly left-wing, and that's kind of changed somewhat recently. Lord Kunzberg You know, this new chap that's recently come on Theresa May's team that was used to be editing, what was it, the Today programme?
Yeah.
No, he edited Politics, the Daily Politics.
He edited the Daily Politics. And he was the orchestrator of the big debate at Wembley Arena, wasn't he? And he's Nick Robinson, also a Conservative Party member at university.
Yeah, to chair the Young Conservatives.
Yeah.
And not just when he was a teenager. Mm, you know, this is well into his adulthood.
I think if you also look back, I mean, I remember very clearly that Andrew Gilligan, who's someone who Hayden and I both know, when he broke the 45-minute claim about the Iraq War, there seemed to be a sort of government, you know, sort of profound attack on the BBC. You know, Greg Dyke, then the Director General, was promptly, you know, left. And the, you know, we have heard from numerous people that the actual remit of investigative programming on the BBC has lessened as you know, not directly as a result, but a lot of people believe as a result of that. What are the aspects of,
despite the BBC being vindicated over that claim?
Well, that's what I mean, is that the government really weren't very happy with them, were they?
It goes back a long way. I mean, I think there's two things to say about it. Well, two big things. First of all, the structure, and from its inception, is there to protect the interests of the establishment, which may have a Labour government, may have a Tory government, but it's the establishment. And secondly, it's the process, how they infiltrate consciousness, how they present a view of the world without stating it directly. So, those are the two aspects of it. But the first one, there's a story from its very beginning in 1926, the general strike, which you're all familiar with, a week in May in 1926, when all the TUC called a general strike. The BBC was just beginning as the British Broadcasting Company, and there was a discussion within government about how the BBC should be used. And Churchill was on the right, of the far right of the party, and wanted to take it over and use it as a means of direct propaganda, government propaganda. And he ran a paper called the British Gazette at the time, and that was straight government propaganda. And the Prime Minister Baldwin said, no, much better that they think it's independent, because then they'll believe it. If they know it's an arm of the government and Churchill is writing it, well, they'll discount it. So he kept it, and that's where the idea of independence, in inverted commas, was born. But the rest of the story is interesting. John Reith, who was the founder of the BBC, as you know, actually sat in a government office when the news was being written and took the news from the government, wrote it, and presented it as independent. So he was absolutely a creature of the government and presented the government's line, but under the appearance of independence. And ever since, you've had this phony debate about let's defend the independence of the BBC. When you look at the critical moments, you know, like the miners' strike, like the when we were at war, there's no suggestion of an independent point of view. They line up behind the state.
Just to sort of be devil's advocate, I mean, having worked for the BBC for a long time, both in sort of entertainment and also journalism, I think that people can be critical of it, and for good reason. But I think the BBC is in many ways made up of the sum of its parts, and there's some incredible journalists there. And although you say perhaps BBC wasn't critical enough of the government in the run-up to the war in Iraq, they did make this 45-minute claim. Fair enough, Andrew Gilligan was dismissed as a result of it, but they made the claim. You know, you have a similar thing happening but with Maureen Jones, who exposed the Savile scandal, who is effectively dismissed from Newsnight, and... You know, the story then came out on ITV, but he was a BBC journalist at the time, uncovering a huge scandal within the BBC. So I think, there are plenty of incredible journalists and commissioners within the BBC that do have all the right, you know, principles, course, and yes, you know, yes, the best interests of all of us at heart. Yes. But I think I think it's just dangerous. If you think about, think about what the BBC did with the Savile scandal after it came out, in terms of actually trying to look at it, trying to work out what the problem was.
How does the Savile scandal challenge the establishment?
Wasn't Charles's best friend?
Yeah, but that's not seriously challenging the establishment, is it? No, they'll be inquisitive about that. But I think it's It's class interests is right. What they will defend. And you think during the miners' strike, I mean, the coverage, I mean, I'm old, so I can remember it, but the coverage was about, it wasn't about what they were struggling about. It wasn't about the defending their jobs and their communities. It wasn't about the police attacks. The only story that was told was picket line violence. Mm. Well, I stood on picket lines and I saw the police putting their £5 notes in the windows of the vans. Mm. And I saw them kicking the shins of miners miners in trainers and shorts, kicking the shins. I mean, I saw them beating them up. Mm. And we made a film for the South Bank show on ITV about the police brutality. Well, about everything actually, but a large part of it was about police brutality in the frame of the songs and the poems that were written, because there was an explosion of popular creative writing. They wouldn't broadcast it.
Yeah,
it was actually banned. So I mean, and that was critical, because the state wasn't sure of winning, and the Labour leadership were quite content for the miners to lose. It was seen as a decisive moment in class
I suppose
politics.
It's about the charter as well, isn't it? I mean, like this idea of, you know, quote unquote balance, you know, the idea that which really seems to underpin a lot of the sort of maybe the more positive elements of some of the BBC's programming, but also the complete nonsense of it, like climate change, for instance, where you have kind of, you know, a 95% consensus in the scientific community, but you've got to bring on that other, you know, person for balance. How do you square some of the things? Because obviously, I suppose for us, you know, the revolution will be televised, which was, I think, the most, you know, activist comedy that really has been shown on television in the last 10 years, you know, was shown on the BBC. You started your career on the BBC. I mean, how do you think that they're, you know, obviously it's complicated, but how do you sort of square those circles? Because obviously they're giving rise to voices of dissent.
Well, their image is of a liberal, part of what they're presenting is a liberal face. They are the liberal face of the establishment. But my point is, when the chips are down, when the ruling class is not confident, then the space closes. If it's an issue that they're quite confident about, like gender politics, then yes, they'll be very liberal. But I mean, while we were there doing our films back in the 60s, Peter Watkins did a piece about the danger of nuclear war. They wouldn't broadcast that. And in the early 80s, when we did some documentaries on trade unions, showing that the membership of trade unions were prepared to fight Thatcher, but the leaders of the trade unions didn't want that. They wanted to do a deal with Thatcher, and they accepted mass unemployment, they accepted factory closures, they accepted the trade union legislation to keep them in chains. They would not broadcast Channel 4 wouldn't broadcast 4 documentaries we made. Mm. Simply about trade unionist speaking.
What would you say the solution would be? I mean, presumably you would prefer a sort of privately held monopoly like Murdoch's even less. I mean, how do you make the BBC more balanced?
Well, I mean, there's all kinds of democratic mechanisms you could introduce. I mean, you could make it, for one thing, a collective of journalists and producers and a whole range of people who are involved in making programmes, and with public interest elements. But the idea, at the moment, it's a series of appointments from the top. Mm. I mean, everything comes from the top.
Like it to be more bottom up.
Well, it has to be if you want any kind of openness. But I think there's another point to make about it. I mean, first of all, that's what it is. It is an arm of the state. I assert. but also how they do it is very interesting, because they do it. But there's always a subtext to the line of questioning. And it's the subtext that indicates what they want the viewer or listener to accept.
Thing is,
so strikes are threats.
Yeah.
Extremists and moderate. They now talk about the Labour right wing as moderate.
Yeah.
While we know they are anything but. Blair's line is moderate. You know, the man who took us to the illegal war, the Labour Prime Minister who privatised till it was coming out of his ears, he is moderate. And people who I'm giving my position away, who want to reassert some of their values, even of 1945,
yeah.
that's extremist.
But you're a well-known Tory, aren't you, Ken? I mean, everyone knows you. You're all up in the Tories' face. Like, you're always, like, always just kissing ass with Theresa May and David Cameron. You're, like, best mates with them.
I saw you at the Garrett Club last week.
Well, Kenny's actually wearing blue right now. It's not even a joke.
Proof positive.
Is it, you know, I suppose at the moment, your frustration with the BBC must sort of centre around their treatment of Jeremy Corbyn in the build-up to the election?
It's not a frustrated personal frustration. I mean, I think it's just an observation that it's an observation of the hypocrisy of the discussion about BBC objectivity,
right,
and is putting it in the charter. Because if you think about it, the stories you choose to cover, anyone who chooses to cover, reflect our own perspective and our perception of what's important in the world. So we'll lead with that story. Why would you lead with that story? Well, because we think it's the most important. Then we'll align the next story, and our angle on it is such and such, and it reflects the perception and the opinions and the understanding of the news editors and above them, and they get the job because of the controllers and so on up to the director general, who is then a government appointment.
Can I ask you, just quickly, because I think it's what's interesting for me in Hayden is obviously that, I mean, Hayden ended up on the front cover of the Daily Telegraph giving George Osborne a GCSE maths textbook at the Mansion House speech that actually really showed, you know, and that was as a result of the BBC actually giving us the licence to do that. Why do you think they commission shows like The Revolution Will Be Televised?
Well, they're all court jesters.
Right.
I mean, there's a court jest at every court.
Yeah.
If you're not there, then it blows their cover of being a liberal, liberal voice, tolerant, open. So it's the hypocrisy that is that I think we have to expose. And when they're confident, when they're not under threat, you can go and say what you like, and particularly on certain subjects. But when they're not confident, they protect the key point that they want to defend.
But you are incredible.
You need to get into alternative forms of media like podcasts and
I'm very glad you're doing this
online.
I'm very glad
this is the real bottom up media. We can be really revolutionary here.
Well, I'm glad you're doing it, but it only works for it only works when you understand the medium.
Let's stop this podcast momentarily to tell you that we are brought to you this week by Beer 52.
We've secured for you, our lovely listeners, a completely free case of 8 special Norwegian beers so you can take Beer 52 for a spin.
Are you taking the absolute mickey? Are you telling me we've got our listeners a free case of beer?
Oh yeah, just by going to beer52.com/roast, you can get a selection of 8 small batch craft beers delivered to your door each month, along with a snack and a magazine.
Ferment Magazine is 100 pages packed full of great beer and brewery stories, and you can read as you enjoy a case of beers from the UK's most popular craft beer club.
Normally you'd pay £24 for a case, but by visiting beer52.com/roast, that's beer52.com/roast, all you'll need to pay is £5.95 just for the postage.
That is an absolute bargain, my friend. And each month, Beer 52's expert tasters shortlist their favourite beers, which will be customised to your taste.
Ooh! Whether you prefer light and hoppy or dark and rich, Beer 52 can deliver the lightest craft beers to your door.
This month's Norwegian theme box includes the Heilerated Unkendaga from Enklunune in Oslo.
Is that the correct pronunciation?
Obviously.
A lip-smacking IPA. Hey. Along with Rala Amber Ale from Egir.
I mean, that was absolutely Norwegian. What are you waiting for? Go to beer52.com/roast and sign up now.
So, Ken, let's move on to your main course. Have you brought something nice and hearty for your main course?
Well, I thought something substantial really has
to be... Vegetarian or meaty?
Well, it could be either, really.
Are you a vegetarian?
Hmm?
Are you a vegetarian?
No, I don't eat a lot of meat, really. I'm increasingly a little fowl here and there.
Nice little fowl, a little partridge here and there, a bit of shot in it.
No, the odd chicken leg, no much more than that. But what I thought we should talk about is that old chestnut, the future of the left.
The future of the left.
But allied to it, democracy within Labour, because I think that's now a critical point, a critical element, because Shall I say a couple of words to that?
Yeah.
Well, the whole why are we in the state of a situation we're in? Why did Jeremy Corbyn get elected? I think because there's a general sense of anger and dispossession and alienation. And I think that's come about now because the consequences of 40-odd years of neoliberalism, so what we call neoliberalism, where capitalism just goes rampant. And
can you define that for our listeners, maybe, if they don't understand what neoliberalism
absolutely.
Is?
Absolutely. It began with Chicago economists who
Friedrich
thought...
Hayek and...
Yes, who thought that you had
Friedman.
To... Exactly. That you had to take the regulations of capitalism, of capital, and just let it, the free market, run without inhibition. And that so that companies should not be regulated in terms of their workers' rights, in terms of the environment, in terms of tariffs to cross borders. They should just go for it big time. And they did that, and they used Chile as a test in Latin America. And that lay behind Thatcher's program of laws against trade unions, withdrawing subsidies to manufacturing so that factories closed because they then weren't viable. So there was mass unemployment. And the benefit of that for employers was if you don't want to do your job for the money we offer, there's 10 other people who will jump at it.
Yeah.
So it put all the... It gave strength to the employers and weakened labour. And that was their project, and they've pursued it in various guises ever since. The European Union is a prime promoter of the interests of the employers, isn't it? And I think that's finally come home to roost. And people are finding that there's a large number of working poor, where people are working like buggery, to use like hell. And they can't survive on it.
Yeah.
And equally, people who are employed and are sick or disabled, they can't live on the benefits that are there, and so people are just very angry. There's whole regions that haven't been where there's been no investment, like the Northeast and some of the West Midlands, like the Potteries and other areas, no investment. So the people have alienated, and just they want something different, and finally, it's all disintegrated. And my hunch is that's why some people, not all, some people voted for Brexit, because it was a way of saying up yours.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know quite what we know we're against what's going on, and there's a way of expressing it. I think a lot of people did know what they were, I wouldn't patronise that at all, but there was an element of that. So I think out of this anger has come people feeling they want a big change, and out of that has come the new direction for the Labour Party.
Mm. Do you feel like it? I mean, I totally agree with you. It's shocking. Mm. We've got historical lows in unemployment right now. Everybody, it's not just that they're working like buggery, everyone's working pretty much. Mm. So why is it that we have record numbers of homelessness and record numbers of people in food banks? It just doesn't match up.
No.
I would ask you though, I mean, I totally agree with you, although I wonder, and my big problem with Jeremy Corbyn after this election is him sort of refusing to take a more sort of strident stance on Brexit, although perhaps he's starting to. But I sort of worry if you kind of, you know, you have these socialist ideals and you want to implement workers' rights and all this kind of stuff, which is fantastic, but then you pull out of a union which is the biggest source of income and the biggest thrust to your economy
I challenge that in a comradely way, because actually the European Union is a driver for privatisation. It prioritises workers' profit over workers' rights, as in the Posted Workers Directive. If you look what it's done to Greece, it's imposed a debt on Greece, where the money will go straight to Greece's creditors, and there's no investment in Greece to be able to regain financial viability, meanwhile forcing them to sell off all their assets.
But why do we have to, you know, why does it have to be either or? I mean, surely if you're a sort of Keynesian, you sort of make amendments to the structure that already exists in the EU. You don't have to be the test case that crashes out and whose economy crashes in the process in order to get out of the rules.
That's exactly what Jeremy Corbyn said. But where the debate was dominated by the right wing, the press, the right wing press, and as we've been talking about, the BBC, only presented the right wing point of view.
So there was a left-wing Brexit argument which wasn't presented.
Which is that the Yanis Varoufakis makes the point very clearly that you've got to end the private, you've got to end the basic economic model that the EU is built on, and absolutely we need to be internationalist and we need to work together, we need to trade with each other on a fair basis, not on one's element bringing cheap labour from another side of the Europe in order to undercut the wages of people here.
So just to fill people in, if you don't know about this, so Yanis Varoufakis, who is the former Greek finance minister when Syriza came to power, went to the European Central Bank, or was it what's called the ECB, and he said, look, we've got a mandate from our people. We'd like to change the terms under which we are paying back this enormous debt. And the ECB is a very strange place because they don't actually legally exist. So there is a kind of black hole there. He was told in no uncertain terms, you can't take notes here. And so the story goes, which Yanis Varoufakis has popularized, and talked about many, many times, that essentially the German finance minister sort of said, look, mate, you know, if we tell you that you can just have an election and you can change the terms under which you're negotiating, then the Portuguese and the Irish and all the other countries who are close to indebted, like Italy as well, will do the same. And at that point, there was this term which he phrased, and it was very well put, really, of a democratic deficit within the EU. So, yes, I think there is definitely a left-wing case to be made. I think Hayden and I, are probably both sort of actually fans, probably, of the single market in some respect. Do you think that pulling out of the single market is a positive way to go? Because surely that wasn't what people voted for. They voted to leave the EU, which is a very different thing.
I think people weren't, by and large, I think they saw Europe as European Union as one item, not broken into different elements. But I think obviously we are a trading nation. We're bound to continue to be a trading nation. But I think the key element is that one working class does not undermine another.
But aren't we in a real danger, Ken? Because if you get rid of, for instance, the single market, for instance, Donald Trump, this will probably come out in a couple of weeks, but as of recording, Donald Trump at the G20 speaking to Theresa May, talking about rushing through a trade deal. Now, when I hear that, what I hear is American opportunity to privatise the whole of the NHS.
The Tories are doing that anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, they're well on the way to privatising the National Health Service. But I mean, I'm interested in discussing Europe. But I think the key point of the what is on the table for us to consume is the democracy within the Labour Party.
I mean, that's what's on the table.
That's what I'm saying.
Ignoring
the feast that I've laid in front of you.
So let's talk about that. I mean, how do you see the democratisation of the Labour Party? Because obviously, there's always a lot of press at the minute about, you know, left wing trolling of MPs like Chuck Ramuna and Luciana Berger, people who are seen to be on the right. There's always a kind of seems like a constant dialogue about, oh, terrible momentum. Momentum's terrible, even though the Tories are now apparently trying to, you know, build their own version of momentum, like a youth activist group. How do you see this future of the left? Like,
fun organisation.
I think it'd be absolutely crazy. Boating, maybe. Champagne dinners.
A couple of pints down the pub on a Friday. Yeah, absolutely.
Anyone's been.
I've hung out with the Young Tories before, actually.
Have you?
Yeah, they like to have it.
Yeah.
They like to get right on
when we've given talks at Cambridge and Oxford, I always feel like you get there and it's suddenly like everyone's in tails and you must sit in the right way. And I always think it's very interesting because I always can tell who I like on those tables by how they treat the waiters.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you see instantly who's actually a really nice young person who's clearly very intelligent. And I watch this smarmy little twat just kind of wave this woman away. And I just remember just thinking, this is exactly the sort of privilege you've probably had your whole life.
The Bullington boys, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, break up the restaurant and then throw a wad of money at it. I think what's essential is that we... Well, put it this way. There's literally hundreds of thousands of people who joined the Labour Party because of Jeremy Corbyn. Many people who were in the left groups, and I was one of them, who could find no point of contact with the Labour Party until Jeremy's election, feel that, yes, this is a place where we can have a serious political discussion now, both to understand what is happening in the country and economically and politically, and also to propose ways forward. So it's a good place to be. But there are now nearly 600,000 members. If there is no way that you can elect the people to represent you in Parliament, there's an absolute barrier on democracy. So I think the idea that people, many of whom will have varied talents that the party should be able to use in Parliament, the idea that there is no way in which the sitting MPs can be re-elected or reconfirmed without some, it's seen as some massive...
You're talking about the deselection stuff?
Well, reselection.
Yeah.
The fact when you've done 5 years is quite reasonable. You say, well, this is my record, this is what I've said, this is what I've voted for, this is the work I've done. Can I have another 5 years? Mm-hmm. And they'll say, well, you've done quite well. But there's actually somebody else in the party who's got an extraordinary CV. Mm. Will make an amazing contribution on health or on education or on industry. But and we want that person to represent us now. Thank you for what you've done. It's nothing bad about you, but there's somebody come along who'll be amazing. Well, if you're running a football team, he'd be in the team.
Yeah.
Why can't it be like that for politics?
But isn't there kind of like, look, just to take the contrarian point of view, because I think that, you know, I do, there's a lot...
You have to say comrade when you say that.
Yeah, comrade. Contrarian point of view, comrade.
Don't say it if you're being ironic and postmodern. I think you only say it if you mean
comrades.
It.
Yes, well... You know, MPs like Jesse Phillips, Chukwuemunna, well-known critics of Jeremy Corbyn. Isn't it kind of healthy within one political party to have a lot of people who have different opinions? Obviously, the Tories are really famous for their division over Europe, and sure, it's the self kind of exposed wound that comes up and hurts them every time. But if we did just kind of had a very sort of, let's just, for want of a better word, call it a Corbynite Labour Party, would that not really sort of scupper debate? Would that not kind of not would that sort of not actually be as positive as having right and a left side of a party to moderate that?
I think you just want basic democracy. I think you're people who choose, who say in a from a town or an area or constituency should be able to say, look, these are all our members. We've considered everyone who we'd like to represent us. These are the people who could represent us. And of all the people, we think this person is the best.
Right.
This is our candidate. That's the point of democracy. You put forward the person you think will be the best.
Yeah.
But I think that trumps everything. I mean, of the people you've mentioned, I mean, you haven't mentioned two, one of whom was deeply unpleasantly abusive when she talked about stabbing Jeremy Corbyn not only in the back but in the front. I mean, that's nothing to do with democracy or an alternative point of view.
I think she was joking, though, wasn't she? I mean, she said it in quite a pithy way. I saw the interview. It was
It's not something you'd say, is it?
No,
obviously. Stabbing people in the back and front. I mean, I wouldn't be terribly keen to vote for something like that. And Chukwuemunna, who manipulated just after the election, when the Labour Party was absolutely in feeling very strong after a result which didn't win, but it was much better than everybody expected. Then Amuna chooses that moment to divide the party.
Sort of a strange act of self-sabotage, isn't it? And I agreed with his point, but pick your time.
Well, it didn't seem... If you wanted to support the Labour Party and you want to have a good discussion about the direction of our negotiations with the EU... Why do it that way?
Was
to make a vote.
I feel exactly the same, and it's strange because you always assume, I guess, the sort of, you know, the right, as you know, I guess for want of a better word, of the party is you know, sort of better strategically, or they're the guys with the Mandelsons in their team, and they're the guys that can manipulate the press and get into power. But the right of the party has continuously been the worst strategic, you know, side of the party this entire time. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
They've done act after act of self-sabotage. It's bizarre.
I think the amazing thing is that, you know, when there is such sort of a popular movement. Ken, you and I met at an event run by the People's Assembly when we met, and the Junior Doctors campaign, that you don't see more of these MPs really putting their money where their mouth is. And you're much more likely, to be honest, to see those right-wing MPs in Soho Farmhouse in Oxfordshire than you are to see them actually on the front line at a rally. And I mean, listen, speaking personally, I'm no fan of Chakaramuna. You know, he's had numerous opportunities not only to talk to us, but he was involved in some, you know, sort of very odd stuff within his constituency, you know, and you know, allegations made about sort of links to betting companies and the like. And I do think that, you know, there seems to be a narrative where there were the heirs to Blair. They cannot accept that the party has moved in its direction. And I think what you know, I've found most edifying about the election result, and not necessarily Jeremy's leadership, which we'll talk about in a moment, obviously a great campaigner, but personally I'd like to see young leaders coming through, you know, people
well,
who...
you need a mixture.
Sure, but for me what was amazing was that the platform of ideas was completely vindicated. You know,
absolutely.
This idea that, you know, really investing in our public services, the basic social contract and paying tax, why we do it. That's
strange. Everyone was a winner. As soon as they were on the front foot, it was easier for them to justify their perspectives. You know, the whole thing of like borrowing and spend was considered incredibly, you know, flagrant form of socialism. We're going to be broke within a month. But afterwards, suddenly people started really countenancing and really serious.
Boris
Johnson. But now Labour are being asked for their opinion.
He's your best mate, isn't he? He's your best mate, Boris Johnson, isn't he, Ken?
Boris.
You love him.
But there's two other elements to it, I think, the democracy in the Labour Party. One is that the ruling body, the NEC, I think it's got 35 people on it, 36, 35, I think. Only six are directly elected by the members. Now, that in a democratic organisation is not acceptable.
Oh, I didn't know that. So let's just go. So there are 35 members of the NEC, only six are elected. So
are constituency members.
Right.
Some come from trade unions. I think 12 come from trade unions. Some come from Scotland, from Wales. I think there's special interest groups.
Mm.
So, but I think... I think there may well be a case for having some from particular groups there.
Yeah.
So that there's a wide representation. But I think, by and large, the members have got to elect the ruling body. It's just, again, another basic principle of democracy.
If you want to democratise the Labour Party, what's your opinion on the force of trade unions within the Labour Party? Do you think that's a democratic force or an undemocratic force?
Yes, I think basically it is very democratic. I mean, trade unions are probably more democratic
even
than
the
most.
Even the influence that they're exerting on the party, say with the election of Ed over David, not to say whether you prefer Ed to David, but is that a democratic process, that influence?
I think there's always been issues of democracy within trade unions, but trade unions are by and large the organised working class. So I think to know exactly what that balance should be, I think it's far too great at the moment in terms of the NEC. And I think but I'd like to see unions affiliated to the Labour Party. I'd like to see them playing a central role. But I think it's the members, both of the unions and the party, that have to elect the governing body. And I think the members of trade unions should vote as individual members for the NEC.
But
so it keeps the sense that everyone has a voice.
Yeah.
It's not taken by the executive of the union, who then casts a block vote.
Don't we have, though, a problem with unions in terms of almost... I have a similar problem with socialism as a concept. It's almost missed an industrial age.
Because it depends what you talk about socialism.
Well, we talked about the idea of socialism and the sort of tenets and even the language often is that of the Industrial Revolution. And what we've now had is a technological revolution. So, for instance, there's no union of Excel spreadsheet workers. But let me tell you, if there was up and down this great country of ours, there would be hundreds of thousands of people who work with these new technologies, who essentially are doing the same thing up and down the country and whose rights are not in any way protected. And when you say that unions actually represent the working class, I would argue that actually they actually represent a fraction currently of the working class, particularly the younger generation.
It's a kind of organisation.
Depends on the union. I mean, unions by their nature are interest groups, special interest groups. They're representing a small proportion of the population that do a very specific thing.
But the question is, could they, and is there an issue around this type of, is there a need to, given the changes in technology, to look at sort of how we even categorise are unions. Obviously, if you work as a railway worker, for instance, there's a very that's a specific thing. But we live in a country full of freelancers.
But you don't have to be an official union to be a union. It's just collective bargaining. There's plenty of unions right now that aren't officially recognised. Like there's a union of gig economy workers, which is doing great stuff right now, bringing the government and organisations, companies like Uber to court. And together, they've got quite a lot of power in terms of collective bargaining. So it doesn't have to be official. Anyone can do it at any time. They could be an Excel spreadsheet workers union tomorrow if you want.
Set up an Excel spreadsheet. Please tweet us, tell us.
I think you're going to be the McCluskey of the Excel spreadsheet workers.
I think that there's a deeper point here, which is it's a question of class. I mean, unions are based on organisations for people who sell their labour to band together so that they can have a collective agreement with their employers, because the employers have an interest in cheap labour. That is vulnerable to, this is easy to hire and fire. Workers have an interest in a wage that will support them and their family with job security. I mean, that's the basic class conflict, and unions are there to defend the working class. Now, I mean, of course, technology will mean that the forms of work change, and the forms of unions should change to reflect that. I think that the other thing that's slightly, I'm not clear about when you talk about the problems of socialism, it seems to me that socialism is not about getting employers to pay fair tax, though that's an important thing. It's about removing employers, expropriating employers, and having industries, the big industries, commonly owned and democratically controlled, so that you can plan the economy. If we don't do that now, we will not save the environment.
I think, listen, so, I totally agree with that. I think that for me, I think it's become a word that has, and I think this has been quite purposeful. You know, I think Saatchi and Saatchi and, you know, the likes over, you know, generations have tried to extrapolate away from, for me, what is the core idea, which is about we, not me.
Mm. You know, it's an economic structure.
Exactly.
It's an economic structure. It's not about getting a good deal with the employer. It's replacing the employer.
Mm. Right. So that was a very delicious main course. That was pretty major. So are we going for a sweet dessert, Ken? Is it going to be sweet or is it savoury? Like, are you more of a cheese and wine man?
I think it's quite delicious, really. It's football.
Football.
Oh God!
Football. So it's
a distraction of the masses. I'm from socialism to football.
Yeah.
Well, you can have them both, mate. Yeah. Have you been in a crowd of 40,000
but
people?
But I'm looking at Harry Keane's doppelganger here, aren't I?
Is Hayden Prowse Harry Kane's doppelganger? If you want to send in pictures,
reincarnated.
Yeah. I mean, he's actually, you know what? He's actually really good at football. He doesn't actually.
I never watched.
I watched him do a Rabona once. Actually scored in the top corner, but he has no idea who Romelu Lukaku is. He just absolutely.
Yes, but the point I want to, the particular cherry on the top is community ownership. And I think this is, you see, I'm sneaking something in here.
I see, socialism. So
and a lot of clubs, particularly the smaller ones, are now being taken over by the fans.
Yeah. That's right.
And it's a terrific idea because it means it is genuinely a club. You know, if you think of the word club, it is people joining together, isn't it?
Community.
Yes.
It's socialism, isn't it, Ken?
Well,
it's a club.
It's people coming together, really. And just...
a club that everyone's invited to.
Sometimes they wear red. Sometimes they sing the red flag. Who knows?
Actually, my friend of mine was recently suggesting, Nimrod Kamer, that given that one of the only things we do well in this country is members clubs, like Soho House down the road, we should nationalise all members clubs. That should be our post-Brexit strategy. Well, nationalise members clubs.
The Groucho for one and all.
But that's what a football... You're saying a football team is a community that gets together.
You probably know Soho House better than I do.
I've been told by Hayley and other actors who've been in your film, in Daniel Blake, that even in Cannes, they'd be talking about going to Potter's. Ken's like, you can't go there. And they're like, Ken, we're not. We're just going home to sleep. And then when Ken was asleep, they'd like sneak out and secretly go to parties, not telling Ken they'd be there.
Couldn't go to the members club.
But parties are all right.
Yeah.
Parties are fine.
Parties are fine. I mean, what it means is you don't have the traditional idea, you know, which it was a handful of businessmen wearing suits and a striped tie control in the club, and the supporters were by and large there, you know, out of the grace of their kindness of their heart. And actually, football is such a popular pastime, and people enjoy it so much. It can trigger lots of other things. People will, I mean, we ran a thing at Bow City, my club I support, due to one guy. He organised a thing around schools where players go to schools, do some training with the kids, and then they're asked to write about meeting the footballer. Well, kids who didn't, the idea of writing an essay was anathema. They would write because they wanted to write down about the footballer. And it like prompted things that, you know, how many goals did you score? And they add it up. And how many could you have scored? And they add it up. It's a way in. It's a way into really valuable things.
Just through shared enjoyment. I've been to some sort of local clubs. I think I'd get into it if it was a bit more like that. It's just the sort of rabid, rabid capitalist nature of it. It just kind of puts me
off. It's just the Premiership.
But I don't know what division they're in, but there are teams in which, is this right? There are fans that vote online for the selection for each game.
That happened once. That was one club. That was in our league.
Does that not still happen?
No, I don't
think. Madness.
Did that not work?
No.
You don't want to take the money to see that far.
Manager. But in Germany, for instance, which has one of the most successful club football teams in the world, which is Bayern Munich, they actually created a model where a lot of their workers, a lot of their fans were actually put on the board of the club. It's the most successfully financially prudent club that grows young players, and actually the model, I mean, it did fundamentally change when Premier League football started, didn't it, Ken? I mean, it was a completely new dawn in British football.
I mean, it's obviously nice that you see, or those that go to the games can see great footballers from across the world, but for somebody who follows a club, you follow the club. And at our level, which is Conference South, some way down.
Conference South.
But people are still as determined to win. Right. You know? So the commitment is there. And the quality of football may not be as
I don't know if you've been to White Hart Lane in the last couple of years. No, I'm joking. Delhi, you're my boy. You're absolutely killing it.
But in a way, it's the commitment to the lads on the pitch, and that's as big as it in lower down the leagues, and that's the enjoyment, really.
But to be fair, Premier League clubs do a lot of social outreach. Tottenham Hotspur are well known for doing a huge amount in the local community. However, something that I find absolutely abhorrent is every year I'll get the letter about the new season ticket, and it just always goes up. And now I've got a lot of French. Well, I mean, it can vary, man. I mean, like, you know, I think it's about £1,500, which is a lot of money.
It's a huge,
you know, amount, and you're talking really about 20 to 24 games, with one cup game, and then you have to pay for add-ons if there's like more European games. But also, it's the price of the kits, and the kids want the latest kit. Like when you're a child, when you're an adult, you're like, oh well, I've just got, you know, a kit that was, you know, 4 or 5 year olds. But when you're a kid, you want that new kit, and that. And I know that those retail, they're retailing at almost 75 quid.
But the point of this dessert that's offered is, I mean, we can all rail against the excesses of Premiership clubs and their money, but actually it's the renewing of the clubs at a lower level through the communities and through every member. I mean, we've got 600 or 700 members who each chipped in a small amount of money to buy the club.
This is Bath City.
But it's true of all community-owned clubs, and every person who chipped in, some people put in a few thousand, some people put in more, some people in the minimum. However much you put in, you get one vote. And you elect the board, and when there's a big issue coming up, everybody gets together and you have a vote.
That's great.
And the thing, that's great. And it applies to all community clubs. So I think it's a way forward. And it makes it more fun. Because actually, you're not then saying, oh, the sodding board this and the board that.
You just want to democratise everything. Well, Labour Party, football. Is there anything you wouldn't democratise, then? Well, you extremist.
What about your films? Would you democratise directing of your movies?
Well, Let's elect the producer.
Well, at the moment, the directors are chosen by commissioning editors in television, or they're chosen by financiers. So democratising it might be rather better than the present model. Mm.
So are you going to make a football about film? Are you going to make a film about a local,
no,
local team?
No, it's just good fun. It would spoil it to have to work at it. You know, it's just what you do on Saturdays without having to work at it all week.
Do you watch Premier League football?
I go from time to time. I mean, I went to Liverpool with John Bishop, and that was a great game. And I went been to Arsenal with Jonathan Morris, who cuts our films, and that's always very nice. But I prefer the lower leagues. I followed Fulham for a long time when I lived in London, and that was a.
Did you ever play?
No. I was like the Billy Casper of to be second from the end. I was never the last to be picked, but second from the end.
I can relate to that. When I was in school, I used to write like formation after formation and suck up to the teachers that he just put me on the substitutes bench.
Julian was the keenest footballer in the world. It was amazing. He would rock up, there'd be a match at 4 p.m. after school, and he'd rock up at 9 a.m. for the first class in his full kit, shin pads,
ready,
socks pulled up, and studs.
It was
for
good.
The lesson. Yes, he was so excited about the
football. It was absolutely atrocious from roast things I got off the back of that.
There was a bit of corruption that took place with you and the PE teacher, actually. You spent so much time in the office of the PE teacher
trying to like convince him of tactical genius, but then couldn't even head the ball. So Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
What can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on next, or are you not gonna tell us?
No, I don't know if there'll be another one. I mean it's
oh,
quite
come
physical.
On. Oh, well, you said that before.
Yes, well any once in a moment of desperation but having been away from home for a long time. It does quite physically quite
I
demanding.
Bet.
So you
and Corbyn, you'll becomes Prime Minister, you have to make that film then.
I don't think you'll need a film then. I mean, the work should speak for itself then.
But you are, I mean, you say that it is demanding making a film. I actually am always stunned whenever I speak to you. You're like, well, I'm here now, then I'm running over here. And, you know, you not just promote the film, but promote the ideals of the film. And they seem to be, I mean, as recorded, you just gave two speeches at the Durham Miners Gala this weekend. You know, What drives you? Why are you still trying to pursue these messages so vehemently?
Well, I think it gets into your blood, doesn't it? I mean that you, and particularly when you see a time like we are at now, where I don't think any of us of my generation ever thought that you would see a Labour Party led by a socialist or someone who is very close to being a socialist, and so I think that's such a unique. Well, not unique, it's the wrong word. It's such an extraordinary, unforeseen moment that you want to push as hard as you can to help it get to fruition. Because it's not there yet. I mean, it's still a possibility, but there's a huge amount of work to do for everyone, both in keeping the ideas strong, in developing them, in keeping Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell politically strong, in radicalising the rest of the Labour Party, in making it function, in making the arguments, and all that, and you know, when you're old you can only do a certain amount, but and as you were saying earlier, it's the young ones who've got to do it.
Well, I mean,
you know, they've got to do it.
We
but you want to give them a hand, you know.
Yeah, we were amazed. We were both at Glastonbury, and you know, watching sort of popular figures of who really do have the attention of the younger generation, like Stormzy, who's, you know, a grime artist. You know, I mean, the amount of times that, oh, Jeremy Corbyn, you just hear people, sort of chanting was incredible. Have you been surprised by how many, you know, young artists and performers who formerly seemed quite apolitical are now, like, very openly supporting him and pushing that agenda?
Yeah. Well, I think it's terrific. I mean, I think there's a mood, isn't there? There's a, like after 45, there was a mood that we really have to do something, and now's the chance. And I wish more people in the film business I mean, it's been the received wisdom for so long. Oh, don't declare yourself, you know. Don't commit. Don't commit. You'll threaten your career.
Yeah.
And I think people begin to shake those shackles off and say, "Oh, to hell with it." You know, we'll just say what we think.
Yeah. Well, you've certainly done that your entire career.
You have a go.
You've done all right.
He's done all right, hasn't he? Couple of palm tools. He's done all right.
Yeah, but they let. That's again is the danger. They'll let one through.
Right.
As a you know, as, again, as the court jester.
Did you hear that, Haid? Just yeah. one. What, so one of us is one. Absolutely fucked.
Why don't you stay here?
I'll just wait
I'll
here.
I'll go ahead. Yeah. And I'll come back and get you.
Well, listen, Ken Loach, okay. Thank you so much for joining us on News Roast. And
thank you. Thank you. It's been really nice to
thanks for your
have a chat.
They were delish.
Okay.
Yeah. Speak to you next week, guys. Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.